This is Audible.
Podium Publishing presents Sinclair's Scorpions, Book 5 of The Omega Wars, written by P.P. Cochran, performed by Todd McLaren. Chapter 1. Gut Feeling. The epitome of relaxation. Alastair Sinclair stood facing the picture window that ran the length of an entire wall of his second-story office. Hands clasped behind his back, feet spread shoulder-width apart, and weight evenly balanced on the balls of his feet, as if at the position of parade rest, Alastair breathed in the view beyond the thick glass on this late evening. A wide sandy beach ran for miles in either direction, and the islands of Gia, Isla, and Jura crowned the horizon. On a day like today, with a whisper of wind and a clear blue sky, it was easy for Alastair to imagine why his great-grandfather, Duncan Sinclair, selected the old airfield of Macrahanish on the tip of the Mull of Kintyre as a base for his scorpions. One of only three survivors from Campbell's Foxes to return to Earth following the time known as the legendary Alpha Contract, Duncan Sinclair chose Macrahanish, with its magnificent views over the cold Atlantic waves, as the base from which to establish and run his own mercenary company, Sinclair's Scorpions. Prior to first contact and the sudden thrusting of humanity into the galactic community, the British government shortlisted the rundown airfield as a site for the country's first spaceport. Galactic technology, however, dispelled that dream. Instead, the airfield fell into disuse and disrepair. On his return to Earth, though, Duncan Sinclair had seen the isolated spot was ideal for his needs. With no industry, and therefore little job prospects, the meager population had all but abandoned the area in search of greener pastures. Sinclair, along with David Buchanan and Mary Stewart, his last remaining comrades from Campbell's Foxes, purchased the airfield and converted its buildings and hangars into barracks, stores, training facilities, and administration blocks. In the ensuing years, the fledgling mercenary company's profits were reinvested in the purchase of surrounding land, and by the time of Alastair's father's birth, the Scorpions owned virtually the entire peninsula, which they put to good use. The Scorpions' honed skill set made them a desirable commodity among the Galactic Union's movers and shakers. For the Scorpions specialized in an area that even the relaxed laws of the Galactic Union viewed as on the edge. To misquote an old Earth rock song, the Scorpions were experts at doing dirty deeds, but not so cheap.
Need to know your opponent's industry secrets?
The Scorpions could infiltrate any facility and find out.
Has a nefarious group kidnapped an employee or gotten their hands on secret equipment?
The Scorpions could recover the execs and the equipment for you.
Does your corporation lack coherent security policies?
The Scorpions could assess and train. Their business model was simple. A company demanded services, and the Scorpions provided it. No matter if it was entirely legal. For administrative purposes, the Scorpions numbered two companies totaling 240 officers and other ranks. In reality, most of the Scorpions' missions called for smaller, self-sustaining platoon-sized units. Thus, the Scorpions' order of battle evolved into Gamma and Zulu companies, each with four platoons. Three platoons in each company were fully mission-capable platoons, the warfighters, while the fourth platoon consisted of support personnel and was responsible for maintaining the standard Mark 8 Caspers. The fourth platoon also provided technical specialists, including cyber warfare, small ship pilots, armorers, and intelligence analysts. The same platoon furnished off-book services. Nefarious jobs that never reached a computer terminal. The tax authorities might have raised a red flag if they bothered to examine the Scorpions' returns,
Why did the Scorpions pay their janitorial staff so much?
Carefully placed cash payments in the right hands ensured such an examination never happened. Alistair watched the gradual sunset while two men sat patiently in front of his desk.
"Apologies for dragging you in, gentlemen. I appreciate it's been a long couple of months for you on Galax."
Alistair turned from the window, regained his seat, and addressed Captain Tim Buchanan and First Sergeant Kroll.
"But I want your initial take on the mission, before I get into the minutiae, which is, no doubt, in your post-deployment reports."
A semi-suppressed sigh escaped Buchanan, the officer commanding 1st Platoon, Gamma Company, but it was barely audible over the seat shuffling of Kroll, the Scorpion's newcomer. The mission to Galax was Kroll's first deployment, but from the weekly updates Buchanan gave Alistair, the first sergeant had performed admirably. Muscles at the side of Alistair's lips tugged upward, but he suppressed his involuntary grin at the uncomfortable response his comment evoked. Like most military professionals, Buchanan and Kroll much preferred soldiering to the paperwork which inevitably followed, particularly as they progressed up the chain of command. Alistair's smart desk had noted his return and automatically activated the built-in Trivi display of a rather long-winded and frankly boring logistics and supply report from the mercenary company's S-4, the last document Alistair had read. Alistair appreciated the demands placed on the Scorpion's S-4, Captain Kristen LaPole. Running logistics for any military unit was a major pain in the ass, but juggling the logistics and supply chain for a unit like the Scorpions, who could reasonably number several platoons on diverse missions throughout the known galaxy, was a job that took a certain panache. A panache that Alistair, despite his best efforts during his time as the unit's S-4, had never managed. LaPole, on the other hand, reveled in finding order among the chaos. And Alistair had borne witness to many a junior officer, including his sons Charlie and James, coming away from their time under LaPole's tutelage, much the wiser. With a final glance at the report calling for attention, Alistair swiped a hand through the floating document and deactivated the display, allowing him to turn his full attention to Buchanan and Kroll.
"Save the minutiae further apart, Captain. Just hit me with the highlights."
Alistair pushed back in his chair until it reclined to a more comfortable angle. Elbows rested on the chair's raised sides, and his fingers interlocked, as he silently watched Buchanan marshal his thoughts.
"Sir, our contract with the Galax was to provide a small training cadre consisting of me, First Sergeant Kroll, and Corporal Vega for the Galax's own native security forces. As you know, sir, the Galax have recently discovered a substantial vein of red diamonds on their second moon, which has a thin, barely breathable atmosphere. Inevitably, the find has created significant interest from outside sources, primarily the Wathaya Trading Organization. They have been pressuring the Galax to sign agreements which would allow them to mine and distribute the diamonds, while giving the Galax a pathetic percentage. The Galax, unsurprisingly, were not enthusiastic about the prospect of allowing outsiders to exploit them and make a huge profit. They rejected the Wathayat offer, and then began to suffer."
Alistair raised an eyebrow.
"Unexplained equipment failure, the odd missing machine part which caused expensive delays, and, on one occasion, an explosion which destroyed an ore processing machine. The blast also killed the operator and the mining company's chief operations officer, who had been escorting the Galax Deputy Minister for Finance around his shiny new investment."
Alistair couldn't help the small shudder that ran through him as he imagined the expanding fireball of the processor's fuel cells igniting, losing containment, and engulfing everything, including people, within a 200-foot radius in a hydrogen-fed fire reaching temperatures of over 5,100 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yes. The Galax government sought our help after they confirmed the explosion was no accident, and we sent you as advisors to the mining company.
Yes, sir, that's correct, replied Buchanan. And on arrival, I reviewed the local security procedures and found them to be...
Buchanan searched for a suitably polite phrase.
As watertight as a sieve,
interjected Kroll helpfully. Buchanan gave the first sergeant a look that plainly meant, shut up, even if you are correct. Alistair suppressed a smile as the image of an old married couple popped into his mind.
Inadequate, said Buchanan. I had Corporal Vega set up a tripline with thumper motion detectors a few miles out from the mine to cover the most likely approach routes. Sure enough, the second night in, the thumpers got a hit. From the readings, we estimated a section plus heading in on foot. We suited up, bounced out to take a look, and lo and behold, there were half a dozen Besquith doing their best to be quiet.
Not easy when you're 6 feet tall, all snappy teeth and claws, and expecting local security armed with nothing better than outdated laser rifles, snorted Kroll,
a wicked grin spreading across his features. This time, Alistair joined in. There was nothing better than an overconfident, sloppy enemy.
As the first sergeant so succinctly put it, the Besquith had no idea we were on the moon. We corrected them.
Damn right we did, gloated Kroll. There's nothing like a Mark 8 Casper and its 20mm cannon at close quarters to ruin your day.
Alistair did not doubt that. The Mark 8s were smaller, but no less powerful than the more generally used Mark 7s, and they were more suited to the type of contracts the Scorpions tended to attract. Unobtrusive, yet superior protection and firepower.
And how did your encounter with the Besquith lead to the Galax renegotiating their contract with us?
They've requested 2 complete platoons, right?
Asked Alistair, noting that Kroll suddenly found a spot beyond the colonel's shoulder, demanding his complete attention. Alistair fixed his eyes on Buchanan, who held his commanding officer's eyes unflinchingly.
I made the command decision to go beyond the exact wording of our contract with the Galax, though I believe staying within the spirit of the agreement. I ordered First Sergeant Kroll to return to the mine, while I and Corporal Vega backtracked the Besquith's path to locate their base of operations and ascertain their numbers and probable intentions.
I fully support Captain Buchanan's decision, sir, and would like that to go on the record, said Kroll,
without moving his eyes or head. Alistair let his chair come upright, fixed the first sergeant with a steely-eyed stare, and spoke. In the quiet of the room, his tone, though low, was crystal clear.
You understand, First Sergeant, that Captain Buchanan's actions could lead to the Galax claiming we breached our contract. That means a fine, a hefty fine, which, needless to say, would far exceed any payment that might have been due to us.
Alistair shook his head.
Doing work for nothing is not a good business model. Unlike Cartwright's cavaliers, I will not see everything I and my family have worked for go up in smoke in the hands of some slick lawyer in a suit.
Alistair pointed a finger as straight as an arrow at Kroll.
Are we clear, First Sergeant?
Crystal!
Replied Kroll, then remembered to tag.
Sir!
Alistair returned his attention to Buchanan.
Continue.
Ah, yes, sir.
Buchanan steadied himself. He really didn't fancy witnessing another dressing down.
Vega and I traced the Besquith approach route to a point slightly beyond what would be the effective range, if the Galax had actually installed one, of any ground-to-air search radar. There, we found a Wathaiat ship stationary in the open, bold as brass. They didn't even have perimeter security. The crew had been busy little bees, cause off to one side there was a stack of weapons crates. A huge stack. More weapons than could possibly be used by the half-dozen Besquith we encountered.
The skin on Alistair's forehead creased into a frown as he considered the implications of Buchanan's discovery.
That type of ship doesn't have the legs to use a stargate. So the Besquith must have had another, larger and more capable ship somewhere in the Galax system.
Buchanan's head bobbed in agreement.
That was my conclusion, sir. This was no ragtag group of Besquith out for a little trouble and maybe some easy money. These guys were well-funded, and my guess was they'd have continued to up the ante until they forced the Galax to sign up for the crappy deal, or, more probably, they took control of the mine by force.
Alistair took his turn to nod in agreement. It didn't take a genius to figure out who was funding the Besquith. The Wathaiath had a reputation as sore losers, and had been known to employ mercenaries to strong-arm less capable races. Well, it looked like they were up to their old tricks. Only this time, the Scorpions were stuck in the middle.
I take it the Galax were not impressed when you informed them of your little discovery?
Asked Alistair. Buchanan let out a chuckle.
They were downright pissed. Did you know that a Galax's head can expand to twice its natural size when they're angry? An amazing sight.
I'm sure it is, said Alistair. Okay. Back to the contract, please.
Buchanan turned to Kroll.
First Sergeant?
Slipping a hand inside his tan uniform blouse, Kroll produced first one, then a second macro-bonded package, each about the size of an adult's open hand, which he placed on Alistair's desktop. As if from nowhere, a dull black blade appeared in Kroll's hand. The First Sergeant used it to slice through the tough packaging and allow the tightly packed contents to spill onto the desk. Alistair's breath caught in his throat, and his eyes went wide as a small fortune in uncut red diamonds glinted in the light of the waning sun.
Payment in full for the initial training contract, and a bonus for carrying out actions not specified within the original terms. And a 25% down payment for 2 platoons to provide additional security and direct action to neutralize any other identifiable threats to the mine. The Galax apologize for being unable to transfer the required funds by ACK. Apparently they are in the process of setting up suitable banking arrangements. I assured them raw red diamonds are acceptable.
Buchanan gave Alistair a half-quizzical, half-mocking look, while keeping his voice deadpan.
They are acceptable, aren't they, sir?
Tim Buchanan had known Alistair Sinclair for as long as he could remember. Tim's forefather had been a founding member of the Scorpions before he sold his shares to the Sinclairs, yet the Buchanans were still integral in molding the Scorpions into what they were today. Rendering Alistair speechless by anything in the known galaxy was an achievement. And knowing Alistair for as long and as well as he did, Tim was more than pleased with his accomplishment. The uncut gemstones spread out before them had done the trick. Though, to give Alistair his due, the colonel recovered quickly. Alistair pushed his seat back and stood, hands once more clasped behind his back. An action Buchanan and Kroll immediately mirrored. Alistair continued to gaze at the gemstones for a few seconds before he addressed Kroll.
"Perhaps you could excuse us, First Sergeant."
Kroll made it as far as the door when Alistair called out,
"On your way out, First Sergeant, stop by accountant and ask them to hang on for a half hour, would you?
I need to deposit something in the vault before they go home for the evening.
Of course, sir,
replied Crow with a cheerful smile. As the door closed softly behind Crow, Alistair walked to the low table set against the far wall and retrieved a cut crystal decanter and two matching glasses emblazoned with the unit symbol of Sinclair's scorpions. The stinging scorpion, contained within a thick outer ring, glinted in the low light. Placing one glass down in front of Buchanan, he deftly removed the stopper from the decanter and poured the man a generous two fingers of the deep amber liquid, before moving around the desk and repeating the process for himself. Flopping into his chair, Alistair took a deep, reverent sniff of the 100-year-old malt whiskey before allowing himself a gentle sip. As the warm liquid flowed down his throat and into his stomach, he eyed Buchanan over the rim of his glass. The younger man was subtly slouched in his chair, eyes closed and fully appreciative of not only the strong alcohol, but also the significance of the traditional toast at the end of a successful mission. Buchanan's manner also indicated that, with the dismissal of Kroll and the arrival of a drink, that the formal debrief was over. Now they were just two old friends, enjoying a chat. Neither man spoke for a few minutes, choosing instead to enjoy the peace and quiet, and of course, the liquor. As Alistair topped off their glasses, he reluctantly brought the conversation round to work.
"So, Tim, how is Kroll working out?"
"Surprisingly better than I thought, Alistair," answered Buchanan, taking the use of his forename by his commanding officer, as implied permission to reciprocate. "You know, I had my reservations when you brought him over from the Strike Eagles, instead of promoting someone from within the Scorpions. He had an outstanding combat record, but he was damn young for a first sergeant position. And Mike Lennox left some pretty big boots to fill."
Alistair automatically raised his glass in salute, taking a short swig of his drink at the mention of Lennox. The man had been with the Scorpions for nearly two decades, having joined the mercenary company straight out of school. His untimely death on Bosnal due to something as stupid as a failed seal on his Casper during a high-altitude drop was a crappy way for a soldier to go. Alistair shook himself from his morbidity, and Tim continued speaking.
"Well, after the events on Galax and our little encounter with your wayward daughter, I think he'll make a fine addition."
"He knows." Tim allowed a cheery smile to spread across his face.
"Mostly. When to make his opinion heard, and when to keep his thoughts to himself."
The mention of Nicky caused an edge of fatherly concern to enter Alistair's voice.
"And how is the youngest and fairest of my brood?"
"Still kicking ass and taking names. Nicky is her father's daughter, I have no doubt. Being a peacemaker strangely suits her."
"Yeah. She always was the more adventurous of the kids, breaking all the rules like they didn't apply to her, and then, when her mother or I caught her, she would plaster that innocent smile on her face, as if butter wouldn't melt in her mouth. I gather you were able to provide assistance on her latest quest for truth and justice?"
Tim, in the process of swallowing, coughed and spluttered as the liquid tried to come back up. Alistair let out a burst of laughter at the unintended plight of his subordinate. After a few more coughs and a wipe of his watering eyes, Tim was at last able to answer.
"Assistance, my ass! Nicky went and conscripted us. She had us go up against a ship full of Besquith. Although I have to say, it was fun being on the right side of the law for a change, rather than the somewhat shady area we tend to operate in."
Alistair raised his glass in mock salute.
and long may Lady Justice remain blind to those who fight the good fight. And let her gaze not fall on those who unintentionally step over the line on occasion, rejoined Tim, raising his own glass. They each took a sip from their respective glass, and as Alistair placed his glass on his desktop, his face took on a more serious look. Alerted by his commanding officer's action, Tim became more attentive.
"I know you have just returned, Tim, but how quickly can you have the remains of Gamma Company ready to move?"
Tim's head cocked slightly, and, puzzled by Alistair's question, he inadvertently paused before answering.
"I'd need to go over the readiness states with the platoon leaders. First and second platoons are deployed with Charlie. That only leaves third platoon under Caroline and support platoon under Gonzalez."
Alistair saw the cogs whirring in Tim's brain as he ran numbers and procedures in his head. Tim opened his mouth to recite the recall procedure and the time each phase of a recall would take, but Alistair cut him off.
"All personnel are confined to base. Not just Gamma Company. The entire unit," Alistair said flatly.
Tim's mouth snapped shut, and he leaned forward until he almost perched on his chair. In all his time with the Scorpions, Tim had never known Alistair, or his father, to confine every member of the unit to base. Yes, there had been a hurried recall of individual platoons, or even, once, an entire company, when an urgent, unexpected contract had come in, but never a blanket-wide recall. Something was up, and the concerned face of Alistair made that obvious. If his boss was worried, then Tim had best be worried, too. Alistair tapped a control on his smart desk, and the Tri-V flickered into life. Alistair oriented it to Tim's point of view.
"Tell me, what do you see?" asked Alistair.
Tim's eyes quickly scanned the list. Mercenary companies currently under contract and, where known, their employees and what the contract entailed. When he reached the bottom, the hairs on the back of his neck stood up. He spared a quick glance at Alistair before reading the list again, this time pausing to reread the specific mercenary companies' names and planets of origin. On most, the planet of origin was the same. Earth. Tim sat back in his chair with a closed mouth exhale.
"You see it too?"
Alistair asked in a low voice. Tim nodded, but decided to play the devil's advocate.
"Could it be a coincidence?"
Alistair let out a snort of derision.
"What? Alien mercs are so busy completing contracts of unspecified types for unnamed employers that it has left a glut of contracts that are siphoning human mercs off-planet in ever-growing numbers?"
Tim shrugged his shoulders.
"That's possible."
Alistair settled his eyes on his friend and subordinate.
"And what if I were to tell you that we received a contract not 1 week ago, requesting an entire company to head out to the Jesk Arm, because some Wathiat was worried that his F-11 refinery was being eyed up by the Transky Syndicate? That leaves one fighting platoon, a support platoon, and whatever spare bodies happen to be hanging around here," concluded Tim.
The men dropped into an uneasy silence as Tim considered the implications of his boss's interpretation of the data. For sure, there could have been 100 other explanations for the sudden increase. But considering what has been happening to the human merc companies, especially the Four Horsemen, the bankruptcy at Cartwright's Cavaliers, higher-than-average attrition rates at Asbaran Solutions, and fleets lying in wait for the Winged Hussars, Tim saw why Alistair might see conspiracies around every corner. But
He agreed with his boss. Someone was taking shots at human mercs, and with the data laid out in front of him, Tim harbored a suspicion they were reaching a tipping point.
"Have you run this past Charlie and Jimmy?" asked Tim.
A frown creased Alistair's forehead, and he answered with a trace of annoyance.
"It was Jamie who recommended we begin the recall and confine the unit to base. Unfortunately, Charlie had left for Galax before I had gathered enough data to be sure my paranoia wasn't playing tricks on me."
Tim pointed a finger at the data hovering in the trivee.
"Well, your paranoia must be infectious, because my gut is telling me that something big is about to go down. And we are going to be slap-bang in the middle of it. The question is, what the hell do we do about it?"
Alistair let his eyes pass over the walls of his office. Mementos collected from the Scorpion's contracts packed shelves that lined one wall. Pride of Place, on the wall facing his desk, a copy of the Scorpion's Roll of Honor, mirrored the real thing found on display at the entrance to the Scorpion's base. The Roll of Honor held an inscription of every mercenary who had worn the Sinclair's Scorpion's uniform and paid the ultimate price. The third wall held a large trivee display where Alistair could call up any information he desired from the Ethernet or its Galactic Union equivalent, Galnet. However, it was a 4x4-inch plexiglass cube sitting on Alistair's smart desk that his eyes eventually rested on. Contained within the clear cube lay a tattered unit patch. Scorch marks darkened its edges, and dried blood speckled its surface, which bore a carefully embroidered red fox head. Below it were the words, "Campbell's Foxes." Alistair murmured the name of the unit their great-grandfathers had fought with. The little cube had become a tradition, kept front and center in the Sinclair's Scorpion's commanding officer's office. The battered badge acted as a reminder to learn from the mistakes of the past, and to never repeat the catastrophic losses suffered during the Alpha contracts. Steadfast on the patch, Alistair's eyes didn't waver as he spoke.
"We prepare for the worst."
Chapter 2. Aunt Kate. In the week since Tim's return, things had gone from suspicious to downright conspiratorial. The rumor mill had been hard at work, as was to be expected when you kept a large number of mercs in close quarters, with little to do but twiddle their thumbs. However, Lieutenants Carolyn Burley of 3rd Platoon and her support platoon opposite, Gonzalez Rivero, had been engaged in business other than idle gossip. The platoon commanders were on the priority recall list, and arrived back at the Scorpion's base before their troops. The unexpected sight of Jamie Sinclair's Zulu Company and their equipment packed and ready for deployment, but still on base instead of halfway to Galax, was indicative to the young officers that something was up. Taking the initiative, the two junior officers quickly outlined and fired off a warning order to those troops still in transit back to the base, so they could start preparing for whatever the hell was going on. Employing the old military adage of doing something, anything, instead of doing nothing, proved correct when Carolyn and Gonzalez received a sparsely worded warning order of their own from Colonel Sinclair.
"Prepare for immediate extended operations off planet. Duration unknown. Mission parameters unknown."
Deciding to err on the side of caution, the lieutenants ordered that every piece of equipment, every power pack, and every piece of ordnance be boxed and ready for transport. When Tim returned from Galax to assume command, both platoons were at full strength, and every locker and storage compartment in Gamma Company's lines were picked clean. Now, Tim and his officers had the unenviable task of keeping the troops busy. Idle hands and troops equal trouble. A prank or joke would get out of hand, and fists would fly. It was a matter of mathematics. The first day he got back, First Sergeant Kroll called his senior sergeants together. Trouble was brewing, all right. A bright spark in Zulu Company had lost a tidy sum at cards to a tech corporal from Gamma's support platoon, and rigged a dye pack inside one of the training caspers scheduled for maintenance by said tech corporal. As planned, on opening the suit, the dye pack went off. But, unfortunately for said tech, one of Captain LaPole's civilian technicians ended up covered head to toe in the wash-resistant, bright orange pigment. Of course, LaPole went on a warpath. To her credit, the culprit came forward, and within the half-hour reaming from LaPole, she learned a few choice words in a variety of human and alien languages, found her monthly paycheck would be considerably lighter than usual, and kept her job. Kroll moved swiftly to nip the problem in the bud, and suggested to Lieutenants Verley and Rivero that extra physical training would be beneficial to the troops. The officers agreed. Thus, at 0600 hours the following morning, 24 troops of 3rd and support platoons found themselves standing in formation as the early morning drizzle worked its way into every bone and joint of their bodies. First Sergeant Kroll, with his sergeants arrayed behind him, stepped forward to inspect each trooper. Tan T-shirts, with the wearer's surname and initials on the left breast, rank on the right. On the reverse, a black scorpion within a black ring, and the word Gamma across the shoulders. Clean-shaven, makeup and jewelry-free, with hair high and tight, no matter the wearer's sex. Anyone foolish enough to infringe on Kroll's simple rules found not only themselves, but their entire squad doing push-ups. Kroll finished his inspection and returned to his place at the front and center of the formation. His legs spread at the exact position of parade rest, and his hands resting lightly on his hips.
"Ladies and gentlemen of Gamma Company, it has come to my attention that you have excess energy."
An evil smile spread across his face.
"Well, let's see what we can do about that, shall we?"
A low groan came from the ranks. The first sergeant was known to love running, and the fact he was in PT kit did not bode well.
"Sergeants, take post!"
The platoon sergeants moved to the right-hand side of each platoon at Kroll's order.
"Right face!"
24 pairs of feet moved in unison.
"Quick march!"
Gamma Company headed for the beach. At this early hour, the Atlantic air chilled their exposed skin. But the cool breeze fooled no one. They would be glad of its wicking properties once they had worked up a little sweat. As the two platoons passed the bachelor officers' quarters, Kroll's raised voice sounded loud and clear across the rhythmic pounding of marching feet.
"Break into double time! Double time!"
The troops of Zulu Company could never prove their suspicions, but Kroll's shouted command was perfectly timed to coincide with his passing of the door belonging to one Captain Jamie Sinclair's quarters. Be that as it may, Jamie Sinclair had always been an early riser, and when he looked out of his rain-speckled window and saw the troops of Gamma Company running past, he reached for his own PT kit with one hand, while placing a call to Zulu's first sergeant with the other. Strangely, First Sergeant Isla Stewart answered immediately. Jamie put her fast response down to the fact she was a light sleeper, and had probably heard Gamma forming up before their PT session. It escaped his mind that the senior NCO's accommodation was on the other side of the base.
"First Sergeant, Gamma Company has taken advantage of the beautiful morning to partake in some PT, and I was thinking that it would be commensurate of us to join them."
Jamie looked at his watch.
10 minutes? Is that long enough to wake the troops and have them ready?"
Isla wiped at the light drizzle that soaked her face, as she and her four platoon sergeants stood in their already dripping wet PT gear, outside the four platoon-sized accommodation blocks, holding the unsuspecting, sleeping troops of Zulu Company. Kroll had given her a heads-up the night before, and she had been expecting the early morning call. Isla had to admit she was really starting to like Kroll's way of thinking. It was devious.
"Oh, I think that should be plenty of time, sir. See you in 10.
Cutting the link, Isla turned to her four colleagues, each holding a flashbang grenade. A devious smile, remarkably like that of her opposite number, Kroll, spread across her face as she nodded at her smirking sergeants.
"Let's wake our sleeping beauties, shall we?"
One by one, each accommodation block door burst open, and a small soda can-sized grenade followed the path of a gentle arc and landed in the middle of the corridor. A blinding flash, then 9 loud bangs, each at ever-increasing decibels, echoed off the walls, the cacophony merging to form an ear-piercing shriek. Isla made a mental note. Flashbangs make a great alarm clock.
"Damn, I love my job," Isla said,
knowing the lingering after-effects of the exploding flashbangs would disguise her words. Isla could barely hear the reactions of the troops as the platoon sergeants went from room to room screaming,
"Get up! Get dressed! Form up!"
By the time Jamie jogged around the corner, Zulu Company was waiting. Jamie and the rest of the base couldn't help but notice the piercing noise and lingering smoke trails escaping from the open doors of the company's accommodation. Jamie came to a halt beside his stoic-faced first sergeant.
"It seems that I and the company may have been set up, first sergeant," he whispered to Isla out of the side of his mouth. "I have no idea what you're talking about, sir," replied Isla.
Jamie covered the short scoff that escaped his lips with a hand and feigned a cough before addressing the assembled company.
"Gamma Company took a 15-minute head start on us. Let's see if we can make that up, shall we?"
The troopers of Gamma and Zulu Companies were not the only early risers that morning. Alastair Sinclair had been in his office for several hours, accompanied by Tim Buchanan. Both men had already drunk copious amounts of a deeply aromatic coffee from a pot that a slow, dripping percolator constantly refilled. Drinking the last dregs of his mug, Alastair considered getting himself a refill before deciding against it and returning to a comfortable slouched position in his chair. The coffee had had the desired effect of kick-starting his body, and any more of the thick, caffeine-laced liquid was likely to have a detrimental effect on his concentration. Glancing across at Tim, he noted the man had already slowed his intake, as his mug sat half full, contents cooling, while his eyes scanned the overnight signal traffic. Tim hadn't fooled him. Alastair knew he was anxious as himself. The commander of the Scorpions unconsciously tapped his fingers on his desk.
"He's late," commented Tim,
noticing Alastair's uncharacteristic fidgeting.
"And don't you think it's damn odd of him to insist on delivering the information personally, and not trust the usual comm channels?"
Alastair opened his mouth to reply when a beeping from his smart desk alerted him to an incoming call. Scrambling to sit upright, Alastair punched the accept key, and a distinctly alien head and face swam into focus in the tri-V. Piercing red eyes stared at him from a humanoid head, the skull and facial bones more protrusive than a human, and the skin coloring so black it was almost indistinguishable in the low-light location of the alien.
"I greet you, Bomak of the Grim," said Alastair solemnly.
"I greet thee, Colonel Sinclair of the Scorpions,"
replied Bomak, equally as solemn. It was only the third or fourth time Alastair had seen Bomak face to face. Well, third or fourth time that he could recall, anyway, for the Grim, often called Spectres, had a naturally occurring psionic ability to erase the memory of anyone who may have seen them, an attribute which made them the perfect infiltrator. This skill had caused the paths of the Scorpions and the Spectre to cross, and for them to come to a mutually beneficial arrangement. When the Scorpions had a particularly difficult facility to breach, Alistair had subcontracted the work to Bomak, who had been ostracized from his community for misdeeds. What the misdeeds had been, Bomak wouldn't say. However, he had penetrated the facility's defenses with impunity and returned with detailed plans of the objective, giving the Scorpions an unparalleled advantage over their adversary. Afterward, Bomak had recommended the Scorpions to potential employers, leading to them securing a few lucrative contracts. Bomak's latest contract, however, had been one of a more personal nature.
I have the information you requested, Colonel. Penetrating the secure areas of Bartertown was simple, and I had little difficulty locating the computer server holding the data on the Bartertown's mercenary pit. I got the details of their contracts, employers, details of duration and type of contract, which mercenary company bid for the contract, and who eventually won it. I also secured the account details from which the various contracts are being financed.
Simple? Little difficulty?
Thought Alistair.
Right. And that's why I employ you, Bomak.
Alistair's stomach tingled with a familiar sensation as excitement raged deeply in his stomach. Could Bomak's information hold the key to the happenings within the Merc community?
However, I regret to inform you, it is not as complete as I desire, and I must apologize.
Alistair's excitement diminished at the alien's words.
While tracing the account details, I inadvertently tripped a security measure, which released a worm. The virus wiped the server I had accessed, and proceeded to wipe every other server connected to the Galnet in Bartertown.
What?
Thought Alistair.
As you humans say, it was akin to using a hammer to squash a fly, and it indicates some extremely capable individuals will go to extraordinary steps to keep their identities hidden.
Bomak then cocked his skeletal head to one side and exposed his neck. The submissive gesture caught Alistair by surprise. He had been busy deciphering Bomak's words, but he gathered himself to respond to the Spectre's cultural demand. Bomak had exposed his vulnerable neck to the razor-sharp teeth of his opponent, putting himself at his opponent's mercy. It was his way of offering an apology. Alistair opened his mouth wide to reveal his own teeth, which were pitiful compared to the pointed, shark-like ones of Bomak. Then Alistair snapped his jaws together with an audible click that signaled, "Apology accepted." In the trivee, Bomak returned his head to an upright position before speaking.
I am transmitting the file now, Colonel.
A couple of seconds later, Alistair's smart desk beeped, quietly acknowledging receipt of the file. Alistair entered a command into the desk, which authorized the transfer of funds into Bomak's Yak account. Another couple of seconds passed as the transfer was verified, before the desk gave the same quiet beep. Bomak's red eyes glanced momentarily to one side as his own computers acknowledged the status change of his account.
I believe our business to be concluded, Colonel, said Bomak.
However, Alistair detected a slight hesitation in the Spectre's wish to terminate the conversation. In the years that he had known Bomak, Alistair had always found the Spectre to be nothing if not businesslike to a fault. So he was momentarily confused by the alien's dithering.
Something else, Bomak?
asked Alistair. The figure in the trivy took a second to gather his thoughts before answering.
Colonel, unhappy that I was unable to completely secure the information you had requested, I made some, let us call them, inquiries, among a number of other sources.
If Bomac had wanted to garner Alistair and Tim's attention more than he already had, then the promise of additional information was a sure way to get it.
Whatever is happening within the Mercenary Guild, it's not confined to that one guild. I have it on good authority that there have been subtle actions within the Information Guild to either delay or make disappear certain communications packets between human mercenary companies and their units off-world.
Tim gasped in sheer disbelief. Alistair's face drained of blood. Not only were Tim's initial suspicions about the Mercenary Guild confirmed, but now Bomac alluded to the involvement of the Information Guild.
Your diligence in completing the contract to the best of your ability does you credit, Bomac. And this additional information is indeed appreciated and worthy of requisite compensation, said Alistair.
In the trivy, Bomac waved one of his long arms in a very human act of dismissal, which both he and the Scorpion's officers knew was only for show. In the dog-eat-dog world of the modern galaxy, you got nothing for free. Alistair leaned forward and his fingers tapped at the keys on his smart desk for a moment before sitting back. Bomac's facial expression gave no hint of satisfaction, as his computer showed a hefty bonus arriving in his account.
I thank you for your generosity, Colonel, the Spectre acknowledged.
Alistair allowed a grin to tug at the corners of his mouth.
Money well spent. I bid thee farewell, Bomac of the Grim. And thee, Colonel Sinclair of the Scorpions.
Terminating the connection, Alistair adjusted his position in his seat, so he faced Tim fully. The man had both files Bomac had transmitted open and side by side in the smaller trivy in front of him. A series of worry lines creased his forehead as his eyes rapidly scanned the rows of data.
You don't look happy, Tim,
Alistair said, not attempting to hide his concern.
Look at this, Alistair.
Tim swiped an open-palmed hand at data hovering in front of him, the action activating the larger trivy on the wall behind him, which sprang to life and filled with the two files he had been sifting through.
On the left is the contract's data from Bartertown, and on the right are the message logs of the Information Guild.
In the display, Tim highlighted a line on the left-hand column.
See here. Three companies of Tortantula have been contracted for heavy planetary assault.
A tap of a key, and a line extended from the mercenary company name to a seemingly random jumble of numbers and letters in the right-hand column.
And whomever issued the contract is hiding behind a pretty serious encryption code.
Alistair worried his bottom lip, as another, then another, then another line appeared in the display as the computer's algorithms quietly worked at matching contracts to bank accounts. More Tortantula heavy assault units. Destroyers. Battleships. The more Alistair looked at the information, the tighter the growing knots in his stomach got. This was all too much of a coincidence. Somebody out there was building themselves an army at a phenomenal cost. Whoever it was would unleash it soon, and Alistair pitied whoever was on the receiving end.
How long to break the encryption codes and identify who is paying for all these contracts?
Alistair asked Tim. A half grunt escaped Tim's lips as he shook his head slowly.
To be honest, Alistair, I don't think that even our best guys could crack that code. Corporal Zhao over in Jamie's communications section is pretty good, if you are willing to bring him in on this.
Alistair mulled it over for a moment. Until now, he had shared his suspicions with only one other person, Tim, choosing not to bring even his sons Charlie and Jamie into the loop. It wasn't that he didn't trust them. Charlie was his chosen successor, after all. It was that Tim had always been his sounding board, the yin to his yang, so to speak. And if anybody was going to spot a flaw in his thinking, it was Tim. However, with this new information, Alistair agreed the time had come to widen the circle of knowledge.
"Okay. Do it, if you think it'll help," he said.
"Maybe somebody over at the Golden Horde. They have the expertise and the resources. If this thing is as big as we think it is, it's going to be a huge threat to them, too."
Tim had a point. The Golden Horde had a certain reputation in computer and signals intelligence. The only sticking point Alistair envisaged was that Commander Enk was so damned paranoid that there was every chance she would jump to conclusions unjustified by the facts. And God knows where that could lead to.
"No. Let's keep it in-house for the time being. Only our own get to see the data, until either Zhao tells us he has reached a dead end, or something else changes the parameters of the game."
Tim nodded in understanding.
"I think it's time to let at least the officers in on what we have found. The second we pull Zhao from normal duties, they and the troops will know something is up, and the best way to squash rumors is with the truth."
"Good point, well presented,"
thought Alistair. Nothing was worse for morale than when junior ranks thought their officers were hiding something from them.
"Very well. How long will it take you to put together a briefing outlining what we think and what we know?"
"Couple of hours should be enough," answered Tim, his brain already going over the format of the brief.
"Convene the officers and senior NCOs at—"
Alistair spared a glance at the clock, which showed 0645.
1400 hours. "And let's give them the good news."
Tim stood, took a couple of steps toward the office door, and reached for the handle, but stopped short of opening it. He turned back to face his friend, but before he could speak, Alistair held up his hand, a weak smile playing on his lips.
"I know what you're going to say, Tim, and I'll get on it the minute you leave me in peace."
With a curt nod, Tim left and closed the door softly behind him. Alistair sat motionless for a long minute before he leaned forward and hunched over the keyboard of his smart desk. His face contorted in concentration as he entered a code. The code bypassed every control circuit on the base and rerouted its command through multiple communication servers before being flung into space. In the trivy, a gold scorpion and its enclosing band of gold rotated quietly as the connection was established. As he waited, Alistair angled his chair so that he could look out through the rain-streaked full-length window onto the sandy beach. In the distance, he just made out the tan-uniformed figures of running troopers as they headed back to the base following their impromptu morning PT session. A double beep sounded as the connection completed, and Alistair spun around to regard the gray-haired, fine-boned woman with carved-from-flint eyes. As she recognized the color, those eyes subtly softened until they regarded Alistair with a maternal look. Behind her, just visible in the camera's range, Alistair made out several slightly out-of-focus figures, moving purposefully. There was always something to do on the bridge of a ship.
And to what honor do I owe a call from the esteemed commander of Sinclair Scorpions at this devilishly early hour of your day?
Kate Priceman said sarcastically.